from Milieu Media Group, in association with Project Curie. This is The Relay, a podcast exploring what it means to build transformational, justice-driven communities and relationships today, with your hosts, Luke Brawner, and me, Seconda Joseph. Hey, Luke.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well.
Good.
Yeah.
I hesitate because I'm so tired.
I feel
it's just one of those weeks, you know?
Right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm coming down with some, I'm not going to speak it into existence.
Yeah.
But my body is grappling, or I don't know, how do I say it? It's fighting something.
Yeah.
At the time.
It is that time. It is
right?
That time of year.
Ugh.
So I don't want to linger too long on the front
okay. Today.
I think we should sort of recap what we were talking about last week and then dive back into this conversation around whiteness. So do you want to catch us up? What is the conversation that folks, if they missed last week, first of all, they should go back and listen. But if they're not, where are we in the conversation?
So in the conversation, again, we have yourself, Dr. Rachel Schneider, and we have Dr. Matt
Russell.
I was like,
2 weeks in a row. He's going to take it personal.
Come on, Matt, don't take it personal.
Do you know my last name?
Brawner.
Okay.
Let me tell you, it's easier to remember your last name because I don't know why.
Well, you definitely had to think about it.
So, Matt,
it's not just you.
Me and names. There's always a struggle.
That's
right.
Funny. Okay, so the four of us.
Y'all need nicknames.
No. You can make it up.
No. Okay, cool. Yeah, so again, there is a conversation that's happening about whiteness, what it is, each, I guess, our relationship to it, mostly their relationship and just my opinion based on a black person and, you know, a person of color, that relationship to it. And it ends just talking about intention versus impact.
Yeah, so Rachel was talking about, I guess, a community that she's a part of, Surge. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's an emphasis for them, is to really focus on your impact rather than your intent. And that's, I think that's such helpful language for something that I sort of, that attention that I live in a lot of wanting to participate and be an ally, walking into this knowing that I'm going to be clumsy and I'm going to say some things wrong, but trying so hard to justify myself by saying, but that's not what I meant, you know?
Yeah.
And, but having to really wrestle with, it doesn't really matter so much what I meant. What matters is the impact of my actions or my words or my even presence in certain situations.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a really good point. And I think that's also a way to I'd imagine that gives folks a little self-grace, right? So it's like, how do you, or a better way of like, of understanding, how do you enter in to decentering whiteness, because it's always, I think one of the things I do want to say and kind of make clear is that, so decentering whiteness and having white privilege, you can't erase white, you have white privilege, right? And that happens. However, folks, because I don't want people to get confused, like, I have white privilege, but I work, so I don't, you know, I don't have it. The world gives it to you, this system, you know, gives it to you, right? You're born with it. At the same time, you can intentionally decenter whiteness, right? And its impact on the world. So just some clarity in that.
Yeah. So that's sort of where we are in the conversation and where we're headed. I want to go ahead and just jump right in, and then we can talk a little bit more on the back end. You good with that?
Yeah.
So here is part two of our roundtable, entitled so cleverly by you,
That Sounds About White.
That Sounds About White. I sort of feel like I live in that tension of, I'm generally pretty unsure of myself in this particular conversation of, like, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I'm a three on the Enneagram, so I'm very aware of how I'm perceived by people. And so in a desire to not be perceived, to not have like white saviorism identified or called out in me, I sort of silence myself a lot, you know? And so it's this balance between how can my voice be used to help without feeling like I'm trying to save the day, you know? And I just don't ever quite know how to manage that tension. I love the intent versus impact thing. I think the hard part of that for me in engaging people is that a lot of the people who I'm engaging don't see it. So I think about like this Greta Thunberg, or however you say her, the Swedish, she's an environmental activist. And like, I was watching a clip of her with Trevor Noah, and she's talking about how, or he's talking about how she had, you know, when she came to the US to speak to the UN, she came on by boat, and where it would have been very easy for her to, as an environmental activist, to just hop on a plane and come over and make this great big speech to all these people and do tremendous work. But like, completely sort of negates the work that she's doing. And so even if her intent was to come over and, you know, get this message to as many people as possible, she could have done that, but she would have still been doing the damage in the process. That, to me, that's one of those things that's easier to sort of, if we put it in a different context, it's maybe easier to identify the intent versus impact. And so the very fact that she did the work that she's promoting in her attempts to promote the work actually does make an impact. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm.
Yeah. Like how you live, how your actions, like just as much to say as what you say or think.
It almost feels like for me, there's a need for like a white 12-step program.
For real.
Because in so many ways, what's been helpful to me is that there's been a need for, I think what Rachel has helped me with and what you've talked about is that there's a whole body of work that only I can do, and that's about me working with other white folks. And the place that, in a sense, and the white savior stuff, the only place that works is in white culture. You know, so in a sense, there's a prophetic sense that my voice has, in this culture, in white supremacy or whiteness, has to have a prophetic voice to it that's disruptive, and to use the term that you used, Rachel. But that's deep work within the dismantling of or calling out or noticing those that whole system and construct. I think within the community that we're involved in, there's a deep sense of decentering that is necessary. Because whiteness constantly wants to be heard, voice wants to win the day, idea needs to be elevated, all those kinds of things that we seek in those kind of power places. And in this new community, it really isn't, it's quite disorienting because it's not about that. It goes back to what you said, Sekund. It's the quality of life. It's this social order or relationships that are ordered very differently, right? And that's not about power. It really is about community.
Or a different kind of power, I would say.
Yes,
power through the collective, power in the process of creating something new, power in getting to like try to live into something that we've never seen before. That can be that I'm starting to find that like once upon a time I had this more like, I think probably tied to like my Christian upbringing, but I definitely had this like more martyr feeling, you know, and that I had to live in just kind of pain and guilt and misery around whiteness. And it's serious. There's real pain, but the pain has to be recognized in relation to what people of color are forced to survive at the hands of white supremacy. But what I would say is that that's not sustaining. For me, like that can't sustain this work. What the only thing that can sustain it is this quality of life question, Sekunda. Like what, like how can there be flourishing for all? And can we live into a different kind of world, you know? And I think that has the potential to free all of us. Like, I believe in collective liberation. Like, my liberation is bound up with your liberation.
That's right.
And for me, it's like seeing the lie for what it is and then seeing that reality of, or the possibility, and like living into that, that is like sustaining it, which doesn't make it easy.
Yeah. I, Matt, when we begin to work together, or when you decided that there was another step that sort of need to be that you needed to take, right? To go deeper into the work that you were doing. That's the way I'm explaining it right now. Like, I want you to kind of paint that picture for us now, because I think a lot of people, what I come in contact with a lot, and I think, you know, Black folks and brown folks, like, all over would agree with me. It's like, you come in contact, and oftentimes you're working with white people, white organizations or institutions that are working. So say we all want, you know, liberation, right? Which you said, and they're working towards that. But then when you get in the relationship, it's like, oh no, you're not. What they doing? That's you. You know, it's, you're kind of like not doing it at all. As a matter of fact, you're doing quite the opposite, right? Or you surely haven't gone far enough, right? That is my opinion, and which is why there's a very, when you hear the word, for me, liberal, right? Like, it has a very bad name, and it has everything to do with racism, right? It has everything to do with whiteness. I say that to say, because we've had this conversation before, where were you, right, on this walk towards liberating, self-liberation, I guess, when you decided to go further into your work, when you decided that you needed to bring some other folks in?
In some ways, I don't know if it was like a personal decision as much as it was kind of a, like all these things started breaking in at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't know how much agency I had at the end of the day to realize, like, I'm not that smart to put it together in some ways. So we were doing this work, and there is always this inside of me, like, that's missing something.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell. It was almost like this phantom feeling of, like, we're close, but there's a whole other thing that is missing. And I could feel it. And at night, when I was quiet enough, I could almost hear voices in the other room that I didn't know what they were or what it was. And so the way that looked like is that I was leading an organization, and it was the center of it, was raising money for it, was setting agendas, was, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know. As I look back, it's a very liberal kind of Christian progressive way of moving. It had steep roots in reconciliation language, right? Really, what happened the Philando Castillo and Alton Sterling's death, their murder, kind of put us at a crossroads in Houston and in the church that I'm a part of with a vigil. And so that's really brought me into relationship with a whole other set of Christians and activists and folks that were moving in the city that were educated and grew out of a totally different root system of language and seeing the world. And when I was put in conversation, or really was put in front of to listen and to learn, I began to say, oh, these are the voices that I've been missing. This is the community that I've been hungry for. This is something that I could not and cannot produce on my own, that I really have to, in language, kind of submit myself to in order to live, right? I think my friendship with my relationship with Cleve that turned into a friendship really was continues to be transformative for me. And then I think the community he was a part of risking the community I was a part of coming together, and all the train wreck that was possible and did happen, and the grittiness that came out of that, I think was and continues to be something that both gives me life and dismantles and decenters this this sense of what what power has been in whiteness for me.
What did you have to do, like, just personally to be able to, because I think that, so I think a lot of times, like, it's like, as we're moving, all people, everybody, right? There are different levels and there are different places where we have to continue to go deeper, right?
Yeah.
But I think when, as it relates to whiteness, there are oftentimes, and that's the problem, right? The problem is not that people have not started doing the work and they're moving forward, but the problem is when they're confronted, you know, or when they are, hey, yeah, that's cool. We're together. We met you in this relationship. Now this is what we need to do so that we can continue to go further, right? Yeah. Like, what is it within yourself that you found that you had to give up to be able to take that step?
Yeah. I mean, in psychological terms, it was a move from the ego to the soul. You know, me being centered, me being the leader, me calling shots, those kinds of things, right? Yeah. It's almost like the Tower of Babel, let us go make a name for ourselves, right? But there's a sense in which at some point that's really hollow. There's something else. I mean, I think what I was deeply hungry for was deeper relationships that had deeper impact in the world.
Yeah.
And not being the center of that, but being a part of that. And I made a lot of mistakes, as you know, at the beginning. You know, I moved in ways that of my own whiteness and privilege that were deeply wounding to people that I loved. And this community didn't let me off the hook. They confronted me with myself in those places. And I had to make, I remember at one particular thing I had moved in a real kind of power move of not, you know, somebody posting some things on Facebook and me, one of the folks in our community posting something on Facebook as an African-American woman that was putting some things out there about some things we were doing in the city on my Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, you know, kind of stepped away from Facebook for about 2 days because I had other things going on and I didn't want to get into the fray. And what ended up happening is that I left my friend out to dry there. Because I could do that as a white guy, I can say, oh, those are just stupid people.
Yeah.
Right. And what I didn't realize is what I had done is I was a part of a community that I was acting in ways that was individual where I needed to be in a collective. Right. I was still thinking about myself and not about the community, and so it was an education, one of the educational places for me.
Are there institutionally, like, how how do you address institutions as it relates to whiteness, if that makes any sense? Right? Is that, I don't know that question. Okay. How do you do what you did with yourself? Like, how do you, like, we are part of these instances. We like this construction of whiteness and racism, like the biggest moves are, how do we get, once we develop this interpersonal, like, you know, conscious and there's a learning and a set of things that you know that operates in a way that is, you know, upholding oppression, right? How do you then take those ideas, right, and those ways that you learn, how do you then begin moving institutions from operating in whiteness and centering whiteness to moving differently? Is that even, you know?
Burn it down.
I mean, it's such a hard question. But I mean, I can only think of like small things that seem somewhat insignificant right now, you know. But when I taught, when I teach, you know, how I try to intentionally structure things so that there's not as much of a hierarchy and that every voice is kind of brought to the table and intentionally providing critical perspectives that and the voices of people of color and centering them. And when I write an article or I do research, thinking about who I'm citing, who am I giving power to, whose voices am I honoring? So that's kind of in my academic work that I think about a tiny crack in the institution, right? But then, you know, there's places where I'm deeply dissatisfied. Like, I go to a predominantly white church and, you know, I find that they're good liberals that have a Black Lives Matter poster on the side, in the foyer, say all the right things, believe all the right things, and yet are completely blind to the very culture that they've created, where if a Black person walked in, they're not going to see themselves or feel comfortable necessarily, and people are not going to create a hospitable environment just because they're saturated in their whiteness.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like I'm thinking a lot about these like small contexts where that entitlement that I was talking about earlier, or just the ways that people shield themselves and can kind of just justify it by virtue of like, oh, I just like these kinds of people, or I'm just comfortable here. Yeah. I'm thinking about how you create cracks in that. And that's what keeps me up at night.
I think sometimes for me, I can, it's asking who's not at the table.
Right.
Because in a lot of ways, what whiteness does is they'll invite people to the table, but they make sure that those folks at the table know that they own it.
Yeah, they control it.
Right, yeah. And so some of that is asking the question is who's not here? Who's not making the decision? And so institutions like to make a lot of decisions about people of color, about poverty, about border issues with folks that are not represented at that table. Right. And so there's a lot of action that is under the cover of service that really moves in powered ways. You know, and one of the things I'm learning around reading Emergent Strategy and Adrian Brown's work is the whole upside down nature of that, that all has to change, that the organizations that we want to build, institutions really have to reflect writ large in small ways what we want to create in the world. Right. And so I think that's really important as well.
Should white people be trying to get at whiteness through their own organizations? Which Rachel, you sure that talked about that a little bit. Or should we, I ain't white. should white, you know, I'm a big we person, but it doesn't always fit.
I want that clip.
So should white folks be like in their own organizations organizing around doing justice work, or should they be collaborating with people in color, with people of color, Black, brown, Asian folks? What y'all think?
I mean, surely both, right? Like that can't be an either or. I think about the company that I'm trying to build and the value that I try to keep at the center of everything I do is that I want to amplify the voices of people who've been marginalized. And so what that requires of me is decentering. It is to constantly decenter. Mm-hmm. But I also think that requires of me, I have to not only remove myself from the center, I have to think about who's at the center. I also have to think about like, outside of my organization, where do I spend money? Where do I spend time? Where do I, you know, I think it's all of the above. We've got to do, we have to, maybe what it actually requires is whatever you're doing at any given moment, you have to be conscious of this. You can't take breaks from it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have to keep it in front of me because it's so easy if it's not in front of me for me to forget and for me to fall into the patterns with which I was raised, which did keep me at the center and are very comfortable and very convenient, you know, for me, unless I'm aware of them. Does that make sense? Yeah. I have to keep it in front of me, I think, with whatever I'm doing.
Keeping it in front of me has required me to intentionally be open to relationships with people of color, because I think that the challenge and the critique that I need is it's a gift, you know, and not that I'm very hesitant to say that I have any right to any relationship with a person of color, but to the extent that that can help me understand what it's like to live on the underside of white supremacy and help me understand my own complicity in it, it's really, really important. And also just to figure out, when invited, participate in any kind of support that I can provide, you know, using whatever I can. But I do think that it's important for white people to do their own work and to be in white communities and to have conversations with other white people where we talk about just our stuff.
I want to ask you about that. So within the last curriculum that, you know, you were a part of, created created this space, right, for white folks, whiteness 101. What happened?
Matt was there too.
What happened? Like, what?
You want to see behind the veil, I see.
Which I was doing. What happens in those spaces? Where white folks do their work. I remember, right, being in Curate space, and I think I was the one. I think I asked, was it you and Matt, some questions? I don't know what questions I asked y'all or whatever. It was part of the curriculum. It was part of something we were talking about, and it had to do with whiteness, right?
Yes, I remember this.
So those things were happening in front of this particular class. It was like, you know, cohort. It was a bunch of diverse folks in the room. But I remember after having that conversation, I had to get up and go. It made me sick.
Yeah.
Right. Myself. And then I was wondering, was it just me? And Andrea came behind me and somebody else, like of color, I think a Latinx person, was like, oh, that was hard.
Right.
Right. So there was me. What I understood from that moment is, one, I understand that this conversation was important, right? And it was important for you know, the white folks that were in the room who needed to do this justice work, right? It was important. However, I don't have nothing to do with it. I don't need to be in the room. I don't need to hear that working out, because, like you said, we do our own work. And me being within that, it's appalling. For me, it's like, to give an example, it's like a person who has been abused being in a space listening to the abuser go from how they feel. Who wants to
and please be compassionate towards me and understand my logic for
my abuse, right? And it's like this, you know, and it, and what's also is going on, because it's not like it's just based on, it's not like necessarily this is therapy, but this is trying to help people understand and face and continue to walk through the process of getting over whiteness, right? This is work that white folks need, right? And it's part, you know, I can call it white tears, I can say whatever, but as human beings, these things need to happen, right? So that folks don't give up.
Right. But that's why I paused when you asked, because
Exactly.
I had that moment where here but you are, at you know.
And at the same time, and we have these moments on the show, right? Because there's always this thing about, we understand that, you know, just like curate, like the listening audience is a diverse space.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is a show about whiteness.
Exactly.
Right. whiteness does not exist without, in relation, with outside of relationship to other folks.
That's right.
Right. So how do we have this conversation and acknowledge that? Well, it's hard for it even to make sense. Right. Without acknowledging, well, this is why it's a problem.
Yes.
The problem is because it's in relationship with other folks.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Right. Also, like, you know, I just wanted people to know that things happen in this space that don't have anything to do with necessarily me, because I imagine other people are listening and they feel like, why do we have to separate? Right?
Oh,
why is it that, like, I think some people come up with it. Like, why would there be a separate class for white people? Right? And why is it important for that to happen? Like, we in this world together, right? And some things we have to work out together. And it is, right? But there are some things that everybody don't have to be
hear.
Part of. Yeah. Everybody don't have to hear.
Yeah. I think your first question about is it the importance of the work? And in some ways, if white folks are going to do collaborative work, I think it's really important that there be a decentering, a deconstruction, a really deeper understanding of how then to what then is collaboration?
Yeah.
You know, and what does it mean to join the work? Not to dominate it, all those kinds of things. And I think the work individually or in groups to deconstruct that is absolutely important.
Yeah.
Because what ends up happening is that I think that the work can become deeply derailed, and stymied, and can be frustrated because there is continued issues of power that go unchecked and live in kind of sinister ways that are shellacked with an air of kindness or strategy or Jesus talk.
Yeah.
All that stuff can live under the cover and still operate in deep, deeply disruptive ways.
Yeah.
So when we first started Surge, we had all sorts of debates and questions about Surge. And in part because we were explicit, we welcomed everyone. So we get this question all the time with Surge. Are people of color welcome at your meetings?
Yeah.
You know, and our answer is yes, we welcome everyone. This isn't a whites only space, and we're not attempting to reproduce a kind of white isolationist supremacist space. But our answer is everyone's welcome, and we want you to be aware that we're going to be talking about things that we feel like could be really triggering and traumatizing and painful. Mm-hmm. And so, like, out of respect and care for, like, just not wanting to cause further harm, like, you should know that and then make a decision based on that if you want to be, you know, attend our meeting or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really has been really important for me to think about this question of harm and violence in terms of mixed race spaces.
Yeah.
So one of the ways that that I've been thinking about whiteness and the use of it is almost like a technology.
Yeah.
That one uses, that I use in particular situations when it is useful and necessary within a particular culture as a tool, and then laying it down.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So understanding that I have been formed and shaped, and I'm quite good in places of moving, but that movement is connected to a deeper community.
Yeah.
And I am moving in a way in order to achieve something specific. And then to lay that down, not as a right, but as a tool for the use of the community.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I mean, for me, you know, when the opportunity or it presented itself, Cleve was like, look, We gonna work with them, you know, you down, are y'all down, basically, right? Just to sum it up. And I was very hesitant. Part of me was very hesitant because, I mean, we were deeply ingrained in, like, just doing work around Black life and, you know, all sorts of, whether it was criminal justice or just all sorts of things. And I just felt like, well, like, sometimes people get lost, right? You partner with other folks and you get lost, like the Black community loses, literally. And I think what came up for me and the reason why, not only because, one, because Cleve was like, Cleve trusted that we could do this, we could partner together and it would happen. And he trusted to go into relationship with you, right? Mm-hmm. And I trust Cleve. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing was that, also I knew that we would do it with integrity. Like, they didn't go in saying, you know, I'm scared, or like, okay, we're going to continue this inner whiteness. They went in like, this is, we can, you know, accomplish some things together. We can do justice work together, but we're going to do justice work within the way we work, right? We're going to do inside out. And then the third thing was what you just mentioned, which is that there are some tools. Whiteness has its usefulness, right? And I believe that those things would benefit, right? The things that we were working to achieve, right? Because, again, like, quality of life, right? There are some things, some doors that can be open, that whiteness can open, that, you know, all Black group, all Black, no matter how smart and whatever we got going on, creative and whatever, it just, those doors don't open the same way.
That's right.
And it has, it has benefited our work, right? And I began to see, you know, I was like, okay, because, you know, I'm moved by spirit, if I'm honest. And I'm moved by spirit, but I was like, I don't know, you know. Rachel, you mentioned something while we were offline. You talked about your time in South Africa and this statement that was made by, I'll let you tell us about it. I don't
want to. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, there was a very controversial article that was written by a white female philosopher named Samantha Weiss. And it caused this huge public debate in South Africa. I mean, an academic article, but it was because it was titled, "How Do I Live in This Strange Place?" And she was asking, what does it mean to live ethically as a white person in the wake of this history of racism and a country where, you know, now Black people are coming into their own and there's still so much inequality and suffering. And she argued that white people basically need to, like, withdraw completely from the political process, that the most ethical thing you can do is just be silent and moved out of the center, you know, really decenter in a way. But it caused a lot of controversy and even pushback, particularly from Black critics who said, you know, no, what we really need is reparations, essentially. The answer is not withdrawal. The answer is using all of the privilege and whatever whiteness gave you and owning up to your responsibility to make things right in the wake of, you know, your sins and the sins of, you know, the generations before you. And so it's this big tension and debate about decentering. And then when you do take responsibility, then are you recentering yourself? To what extent, you know, when Matt talked about using whiteness as a technology, but I find that it's not always so easy to take it on and put it off. And it's seductive. It gets its hooks into you. And so that tension of when do I step, and I think Luke spoke to this earlier, but when do I step back? When do I step in?
Yeah.
That feeling that out is a constant process that sometimes you get wrong and sometimes you get right. But I feel like if I had to err, if I was in this debate, if I have to err on one side or not, I'm going to err on the side of taking responsibility, being engaged and maybe messing up versus withdrawing and living in, you know, convincing myself that I'm doing the right thing by just sitting passively.
Yeah.
So I might as well try and get it wrong.
Yeah. And I think that came up because we were talking about even this conversation, right? Which is centering whiteness, and right? And it's uncomfortable, right? It's particularly when you practice decentering on whiteness. And we've had many of these conversations, Luke and I, along with, you know, other members of the team, about how easy it is to do within these conversations, period.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about that recently. And like, one of the struggles for me is like not wanting to create a show that's aimed at white people who are trying to be more woke, or however you mm-hmm. want, however you want to frame it. But also, like, I am where I am in this conversation, and I do come in as a cisgendered straight white man, and I'm trying to do the work. But how do I do that work honestly without it feeling like I'm trying to once again center mm-hmm. either my voice or my perspective or that of white people? But how do I bring questions honestly without changing the sort of trajectory of the show?
Making it all about your process.
Right. Right. What I seem to find in the relationships that I'm in too, and I think part of the reason why it ends up being such a struggle to sort of communicate, I mentioned earlier that it's, you know, it hasn't gone well for me usually. It's because it's very often I'm having these conversations with folks who are privileged in other ways as well. So to make someone aware of their whiteness without, you know, if it's another straight white man who doesn't recognize the other privilege in the intersections that they live, it's hard to point out the one when they're still oblivious to the others, you know, or even if it's someone who's doing like good feminist work, but feels justified or feels okay because they are doing that work. It's like, you're telling me I've got to take on also this other right. piece of my identity. And that is what we're saying. But that's I think that's part of what I run into, is that it's people who are oblivious in lots of ways, not just around their whiteness. So I love this whole conversation about decentering whiteness. One of the things that I was sort of struck with, though, this week, I received an email from a dear friend who's a friend of Project Curate this week in response to the episode. And she talked about, there was a line in her email where she, you know, she's talking about sort of the work of, or really even the burden of feeling like the white person in the room who has to speak up in a room full of white people, you know, when things are being said that shouldn't be or whatever. And she talked about how she has to remind herself that it's not ignorance that she's combating, it's systemic oppression. Okay. And that is particularly convicting to me, especially in light of the end of our roundtable, because I always think in terms of like, well, there's people who are just oblivious. And that's sort of this idealistic view of the world where it's like, I guess in my mind, I think if people only saw, if they understood the way in which their intersections are centered in the world or privileged in the world, then they would obviously act in a particular way to change that. And that's simply not true. And I have to remind myself of that like, she's right. It's not just obliviousness that we're up against.
Yeah.
It is a system that privileges and favors, you know, that's not just a thing that happened by accident.
Come on.
It's a thing that is protected.
That is intentionally protected. I think some of the easiest way to see how, like some things are so obvious. And it's clear. For example, let's talk about the Civil War and the preservation of icons of the Confederacy, mm-hmm. right? These statues, these men, their names, even what it was about. Like, there was intention on how do we create and control this narrative, keep this flag. Bree Newsom, I hope I ain't saying her name. If I am, y'all know who I'm talking about. The artist who pulled down the Confederate flag several years ago, and she did it with intention. So right after, in South Carolina, there was a group of folks having church, and a young man came in and murdered them. Right? We all know this story. We all know sort of what happened, where at that time, all flags stood half staff, every flag except for the Confederate. And one of the things that she said, I heard her, had the opportunity of hearing her last year talk about it, speak about it, is she said that it was intentional. That flag was symbolizing something in this country, and it is that whiteness is the ultimate power. So, like, it is the ultimate. So the American flag was raised half-staff, the state flag, everything except for the Confederate flag. And when she was going up, you know, to pull it down, she was like, you know, I was people thought I was just talking. She was like, I was literally, like, praying and talking, you know, personal. It was real because she knew exactly what this symboled. Lies, you know, what she was doing as she moved up, and she knew what the consequences could be, but yet and still she went, and she thought that it was important to create some new symbolism or to consistently push back against whiteness, and that's why she did it, right? It wasn't, it was planned, it was intentional, and it was based on really pushing back on the powers that be, which for her, which I agree 100%, that is like this whiteness that I think controls the way this system, this state, this country moves and breathes. It's the basis, I think, of this country. Like, what is the heart of the country? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What are the laws? Where do they stem from? Where are the roots? And I would say it's in whiteness.
So then what would be some examples in your mind then of what it means to decenter that particular power structure?
I want to first, because I know some people are like, what are y'all talking about decentering, right? So like the definition of decentering is like displacement from a central position, which is especially of the individual human subject from a primary place or central role, right? So it's taking something that's always center. And just to give you like an example of how whiteness or how people are centered, right? Because in this, maybe we should have mentioned this when we opened up, but we didn't. And I'm coming back around to your question, Matt. But I want to say something. I mean, Luke.
Oh my goodness.
Y'all don't look
like talk about coming full circle. There it is.
I was thinking about Matt. That's why I said that. But so in this earlier conversation, or in this conversation, we talked a lot about, because myself, Rachel, and Matt, if you're just now listening to this podcast, so we do work together, right, with an organization called Curate that Matt originally, that was his stuff, that was birthed out of Matt, and then we all came together later on. However, even when people first, when they're first introduced to us, they automatically look to Matt, right? But the way our leadership works is we take a very centralized leadership position, right? So we don't go to Matt to ask Matt what it is that we need to do or where is it that we need to look. We come together as a group to make decisions, right? They may have particular people who are, it is more of their responsibility to handle this type of work, right? And this is where they lead on because that's where their gifts lie,
right?
But not because... not because he started it.
It's not about
power. Because he a white man. Not because of power. And same thing, you know, even with Cleve, right? So sometimes people will look and they'll be like, oh, yeah, it's Matt or Cleve. No. Like, that is, and the decentering work happens by Matt on his end has to, you know, oftentimes step back. Like he has to sometimes open up or say something like, oh, no, this person is handling that. Or, you know, sometimes it's with, and I'm making this part up, right, just because I think it's an easy way to do it, right? But just to give an example of, like, how that happens, well, maybe someone reaches out to Matt and say, hey, this is what I want to do, blah, blah, blah. And maybe they have a relationship with Matt, right? Or maybe not. And Matt directs them to someone else, right? But then they
continue to go back to Matt. You know, that, well, in some ways, Matt, it's his responsibility because he's white, right? To decenter himself as, hey, yeah, I don't know anything about that. This person is the, you know, so those are like you need to go to, I'll use Brandy as example. Go to Brandy with that. You know, she's the, you know, she's leading it. Like, you know, she has all the information or the intelligence or the access or the authority in this space, right? So in our work, we have to decenter whiteness. But I think every day, like, I think it's easy for other people to understand what that looks like. I think especially for women, because, for example, you know, you could be, you know, going to purchase a home, right? And someone looks to the man. As if, you know, you may be right. It might be your brother or your cousin, right? Or your father. Who knows? I don't know. Or your husband. But your husband, maybe he's not the one that's going to make this decision, right? Or maybe you're the one that, for whatever reason, folks look to you as if they center the man, right? It happens. And I think that's easy for people to kind of understand. But it happens with whiteness, like, every day in all kind of situations, in any kind of space. And what that leads to is that if we're all educators, right, and we all have a say on, we're sitting around the table, or like you and I are sitting around the table and a couple of other people, and we're making decisions regarding the show, right? And you have an opinion. I have an opinion. However, the way whiteness usually works is that your opinion is given more, like, it's more valid. Right. It has more power, right? It's more valuable. Your work is worth more money, right? Your, whatever that looks like, the people are more appreciative to have you, right? So then when the flyers are printed, Luke's standing in the front and me and Jessica in the back, like, you know what I mean? He's like, Luke's standing in the front, in the middle, in the center, literally. I hope I didn't go too long with that, y'all, but no. I just want people to, like, envision, because I think that looks different. We've all interacted with that in different places, in different spaces, whether it's professional or, you know, just other spheres of our lives. But I think it's important for us both to recognize when whiteness is being elevated, right? And also for white folks who are concerned. Like, we're not talking to people who are not concerned about decentering whiteness because they don't care.
Right. They're not listening to the show.
Right? And if they do, they mad as hell. They're looking for reasons not to, right?
We'll get those emails too. Right?
But for folks who want to, like begin to, like, pay attention, right? Because I am 100% sure that if you're around some other folks or whatever, and not even, like, I'm sure that you are, or, you know, whatever your organization is compared to some black organization that's doing the same work is being centered. And those other, that other group may be more effective, to be honest. You may be doing work in a similar atmosphere. I give examples for, like, black groups that are, because we talk about black groups on here, right? Black groups who are doing the work in their own communities, but they're not necessarily looked at for, and I mean nonprofits, right? They're not necessarily, like, looked at as, oh, these are the thought leaders as it relates to this work, when they really are, right? Because not only are they understand the group of people that they work with, like, it's their people. They may have been doing it longer, whatever. Just have different ways and new ideas of doing the work. But then the groups or organizations that are centered are groups that are not black led. Now, you might have black folks there. That's not the same thing.
Right.
Right.
So. Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that, one of the things that I've encountered, especially if we have white listeners who are maybe beginning to wrestle with this idea for the first time of decentering, a word of warning from my experience is that you'll have folks who sort of oppose this whole, the whole idea that there is racial injustice in the world. I mean, people who just choose to be blind, willfully blind to it, who will accuse you when you try to decenter of virtue signaling. That's a big thing right now. That I mean, I've had friends try to call me out about this show.
Tell me what that is, virtue signaling.
Virtue signaling. It's an accusation. And I think it exists. There are people who do this. But I don't think that's always what it is. So people who think if you're a white person talking about decentering whiteness, or if you're a white person talking about equity for black people, what you're actually doing is like raising your hand and saying, hey, look how good I am. Look how virtuous I am. Look how woke I am. And maybe that exists. Maybe there is some of that. I mean, I'm certain there is. There's absolutely people who want to be, who want to have the reputation of being an ally,
yeah,
or of being, you know, on the right side of history is what you hear a lot, but who actually aren't.
Yeah.
So the assumption, because those people do exist for a lot of people, is that all of us, you are white and an ally, you're actually just trying to get attention. You're actually just trying. It's actually a centering move, not a decentering move.
And can't, my question is, can it be both? Like, because I come across well-meaning white folks who, when it comes to like in relationship with, or sometimes the conversation, the way they come into conversation is like, oh, like I do this and da 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 da. Like I'm not trying to be funny, but I don't want to hear all that, right? Yeah. Instead of coming to me like human to human. However, that still doesn't cancel out the work that they're doing with white. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like you can be, I can be in my own sphere, right? Or I can, with my own folks, like I could be like, oh yeah, look at me. I do, you know, dope shit or whatever, you know? And don't get me wrong, absolutely, there is a lane, I think, because of the way whiteness works, where it's very easy for white people who are doing racial justice work to be centered and to be like, you know, again, their books get published, right? If they're doing that type of work, their show would get lifted up, right? Mm-hmm. If they're doing that type of work, they're, however that looks, right? I mean, I worked with a white person early on in my work who very much centered herself. Mm-hmm. And it was a very educational moment for me. How easy it was, how reporters would automatically like put the camera in her face, mm-hmm. right? And even as the story is told later on about the work that we did, a lot of the work that happened with Sandra Bland, and a lot of black people who were like, you know, sitting in front of that jail every day, you know, who even directed her to get there. Like oftentimes, even when you look on HBO, you're not going to see them, you're going to see her. Hmm. And the reason why you see her is because she was very intentional in centering herself. I mean, if I could tell you, like, you know, I don't think it takes me doing that, but there was very small, like that was what's up. And yet that has nothing to do, even when people think that. Right. If I think a person who's dedicated to the work that they're doing, like two peas in a bucket, like, well, you know, no, I ain't gonna say that.
I think you just invented that right? phrase.
No, it might be NWA or somebody back in the day. So you know what it was going to follow. But that has nothing to do with commitment. Like people are not going to always agree with you. People. And if you're looking for, I think, if you're looking for that pat on the back, this is not the place. Like giving up power is not the place to find a pat on the back. But I would say to anybody who's doing justice work, like I wouldn't be able to do it if I wasn't surrounded. So if I had not been surrounded by people, a community of people who I could, you know, throw ideas back and forth with, that I can really, you know, walk this thing out with. Yeah. Right. And that's, you know, as a black person, I think as anyone who begins to say, this is the work that I'm going to do, like, I wouldn't say go at it alone. Like, you're going to need other people, other like-minded people who are about their work so that you can be fed and that you can, you know, have a nice quality of life. Like, mm-hmm. kind of like what Rachel said. Like, you know, at one time, I think in this thing, Rachel was like, I thought that I had to be a martyr. No. You know what I mean? Like, you know, but that's why Surge and spaces like that were created, mm-hmm. so that there would be a space for white folks to be able to have their own space, need their own space. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But like to do that, to do all of that, right? And yeah, and I think it's better for all of us when those things happen.
Yeah. And I think that the accusation, regardless of whether or not it's true or right, is a way of resisting your own, yeah. having to wrestle with these truths. You know,
yeah.
it's just a way of defending yourself against any potential conviction that you might feel. And so it's, you know, that's one of those things that I say it only to say, be ready if you join in the work. And as you, you know, for especially, I think, white people who are trying to participate in and co-conspire in this work, just know that that's one of the things you might run into. It's one of the things I've run into. So,
yeah.
Well, as always, Sikandha, it's a joy. We've got a couple more episodes for this season, and then we're going to take a little break, which will be great. And so we'll be back next week with a new table, a new topic. It's going
to
be great.
Glad y'all listening. Look forward to talking to you again, Lou.
Perfect. We'll see you next week.
All right. Peace. Next week.
The Relay is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Luke Bronner. Co-produced by Dr. Jessica Davenport, and our artwork is by Heather Hale. Check out more of her work at halehouse.co. Learn more about Project Curate at projectcurate.org and The Relay at therelaypodcast.com. For bonus content from this and other Mil U Media Group podcasts, check out the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode.